I do see the recording icon in the top, so we'll assume he's with us.
Okay. So anyhow, this is kind of a unique crash report because right in the middle of these 3 years was the pandemic that we have never experienced before. And that really affected traffic volumes. It affected crashes. It affected how people work. In my opinion, had a huge impact on transportation. What's happened is in 2020 during the pandemic, both traffic vehicle miles traveled and crashes and injuries have dropped. And then as everyone can probably notice, in 2021 and even up to today, things have slowly kind of inched back toward normalcy. As of 2021, traffic was still below the pre-pandemic levels, and crashes, are still down a little bit. So that's definitely good news. When we look at statistics a little closer, serious injuries in the 3 years stayed nearly the same. Actually, over the past 10 years, we've done a pretty good job reducing serious injury crashes. But unfortunately, the one area that has been kind of the sore spot with safety is fatalities. In 2020, although traffic dropped, fatalities spiked up, and in 2021 just kind of stayed there. And we are not sure why that happened. Many in the industry think that perhaps just less traffic resulted in higher speeds. Yes, Mr. Durst. You're muted, sir.
Do you relate those to being auto, bicycle, all?
This is everything. These are all crashes. The first part of the report is all crashes, vehicular, pedestrian, and bicycle. Crashes. We'll talk more specifically about bikes and peds in a few minutes, because we do have a special, we do give them some special attention. So anyhow, that is kind of the bad news. I looked at 2022 as of, I think, yesterday. 2022, our region had 49 fatal crashes. So I'm not sure how that compares to last year at this time, but it indicates that possibly 2022 might fare a little better. We download our crashes from ODOT, from a database that they maintain, and then basically we import it into our own GIS layer, and then our staff checks crashes. They check to see if they're plotted correctly. If many times a crash is plotted where the officer did the report instead of where the crash actually happened, many times they'll pull into a parking lot maybe sometime later and actually do the report, and that's where the coordinates get stamped, and that's where the crash is recorded. So over the years, we've kind of had a pretty good idea of what to check, and I have a high level of confidence that when we're done with the data, it's pretty much where it should be. One thing that we've noticed is a lot of police officers in Akron come back to the police station and the do the report, use those coordinates, and unless you check those, it shows that the intersection right by the police station is one of the worst in the area. So that's why it's really important to do the checking that we do. We divide them into intersection, non-intersection. A lot of things play into that. Basically, though, 250 feet within an intersection is usually, but not always, considered an intersection crash. Roadway sections and intersections, we have to we have minimum criteria in order for it to make our list. Three crashes per mile per year for sections, nine crashes in a three-year period for intersections, and for both, they 30% of the crashes have to be injury or fatalities. And we no longer use a crash rate. That's one of the changes that we've implemented the last few years. Then we do a composite score based on number of crashes and the percent of injury and fatal crashes. And that's more or less how we compile the list. That's how we rank them. So actually, a location with a lower score would actually be a worse location because it would have higher rankings. So there were 143 roadway sections that met the minimum criteria. Those are in table one of the crash report. There were this year, there were actually two sections tied for first place. The first one was in Kent, State Route 59 from Alpha Drive to State Route 261. And the other one was in Springfield Township. It was Maslin Road from Crumroy Road to Oaks Drive. That was that's just south of 224. Intersections, there were 231 intersections that met the minimum criteria. Those are in table two of the crash report. The number one intersection is kind of shared with our with NOACA, our MPO neighbors to the north and west, and it is the intersection of Medina Line Road and State Route 18. This intersection is one of those ones where you have high speeds on 18. You have a lot of traffic. You have a lot of turning traffic, traffic turning left. And it's it just has a lot of the right ingredients for a high crash intersection. Now, they have done a lot of improvements through there over the years, but it's just still one of those intersections that has a lot of things that make an intersection somewhat hazardous. Freeways, we don't really analyze freeways. We let ODOT do that. We can't use any of our funding on freeways. So we kind of just let the analyses and the funding of those locations up to ODOT. They take like 1/10 long segments, and then they across the state come up with the top 50 rural and urban locations. Bike and ped crashes, these are a little different than vehicular crashes. They have very high percentage of injuries. We don't really have a list of these, and they happen somewhat randomly. If anything, I would say they happen in proportion to maybe population density. It's just hard to come up with like a intersection where maybe 10 of these happen, because they're more spread out. Many involve younger people. That's partly because when you stop and think about it, someone under the age of 15 is actually using a bicycle as a vehicle on a public road without actually knowing the rules of the road because they're not driving yet. So education is often a very effective countermeasure. Bicycle crashes kind of followed the same trend as other crashes. They went down significantly in 2020 and then inched back up a little bit, both in number of crashes and in number of injuries. Fortunately, the number of fatalities didn't increase. There was one in 20 and one in 21. I showed this graph because normally bicycle crashes happen in the summer when riding weather's nice and you have longer days. Something happened this in 21, though, in September. Usually this graph is kind of a pretty is a pretty normal bell-shaped curve, but for some reason in September there were there was a little spike, more than usual, and I looked at them, but I just without studying them further, I couldn't come up for with an actual reason why that happened. I'm thinking that September is really a nice in my opinion, we have some of the nicest weather in September for outdoor activities. It's not as humid, it's not as hot, and maybe that plays into it. I'm not sure. Kids are going back to school, college kids. Yes, Mr. Brubaker.
The thing that popped into my mind is that September is the month where the sun sets in line with east-west roads.
Yes.
And I remember in years past, there was a really horrible bike.
Yes. If I'm not mistaken, that happened in Richfield, didn't it?
Just west of the valley.
Okay. I remember that crash, though, because I remember the sun. I think the sun blinded the driver, and they just simply couldn't see them.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So there could be a number of reasons. I know sometimes, certain times of year, I think it actually is in September, October, driving into work. I drive on a east-west road, and it is sometimes that sun is just right there. It's just up over the horizon, and it is really tough to see. Mm-hmm. Plus, September's the month colleges go back, schools go back. I don't know, but anyhow, I thought that I'd show that. That was a little unusual. This is a graph shows ages. As you can see, there's quite a few that happen in the age group of 15 and under, and then it goes up a little bit as we age, but I think sometimes when we think about bicycle related crashes, we don't consider the number of younger people involved. Pedestrian crashes followed the same trend. They went up a little bit, both number of total crashes and then number of injuries. Fortunately, fatalities went down by one. There's always more pedestrian fatalities than bicycle, but that's because there's actually generally more pedestrians than bicycle crashes in general. There's just a lot more pedestrians on the roads. I mean, when you stop and think about it, like every day I am a pedestrian. You know, when I walk from where I park to work, I cross the street, and you know, every day I'm a pedestrian. But I, you know, many, you know, I might only ride my bike, sometimes in the summer. So there's also a lot more chances of conflicts. I've showed this before, no surprise. For some reason, October is always the worst month, for pedestrian crashes. They always go up in October, and the only thing I can think of is weather's still nice, people are out walking, running, whatever, and mornings are darker, evenings are darker, and they're just hard to see. I mean, sometimes pedestrians are just really tough to see once it starts to get dark.
Dave?
Yes?
Bill put a question in the chat. He just wanted to know, does the age of the bicyclists on that chart that you showed,
yes,
is that a three-year study, or is that is that just 2021?
Oh, no, that's the three-year study.
Okay.
That's for 3 years. Time of day, I like to show this because you can see the 7 to 8 little spike in the morning. That's when a lot of, I guess you sort of have like a pedestrian rush hour, kids going to school, people walking to work, maybe walking to the bus stop. And then after 2, it kind of goes up again. I call this the after school time when you have a lot of, you just have a lot of people out going home from school, going home from work, and then you have a lot of recreational people out walking, running, and such for recreation. This is very similar to bicyclists. It shows that a lot of the incidents involve people under age of 15. I thought it was interesting, though, you do have a little spike between 20 and 24 years old. I'm thinking that's kind of the college age group. Maybe that might play into that. I'm not positive. And then, it kind of goes up again as the ages go up. Maybe when you're, as a fact, I can, from just my own experience, as you age, sometimes your vision and such, hearing vision and such isn't quite as keen. So you have a little spike at that end too. Safety performance measures. This is a requirement for the ODOTs and the MPOs. We have to keep track of number of fatalities and then fatalities per million vehicle miles traveled, serious injuries per vehicle miles traveled, and number of non-motorized fatalities and serious injuries. And the way this works is we started in 15, and we actually do a five-year average. We do a five-year average because it if you have like one strange year, one kind of a fluke year, it kind of averages that out. So we started in 15, and that the numbers under the 15 five-year average column are averages from 2011, 2012, 13, 14, and 15. And then every year after that, we do it a different 5 years, and then we compare it to that original 5 years. Unfortunately, with fatalities, we didn't do too well. The percent change has gone up. Yes, Mr. Durst.
I was just wondering, if you look back 5 years or to the previous 3 years alone, does it seem to indicate the same troubled spots on the lists?
A lot of the same locations come up. Now, do you mean in terms in relation to bicycles and pedestrians, or in terms of everything?
I'd say in everything, because the maps that were in the materials it's in the materials. It shows these dots are intersections where we have problems, and
yes,
these roadways are ones that are labeled as problems. And I just don't on hand have a reference if
yes,
they are the same intersections and roadways from 3 years ago.
Yeah, we see many of the same ones. Our focus kind of shifted. I think 2 or 3 years ago, our focus kind of shifted from number of crashes to focusing on severe and fatal crashes, severe injury and fatal crashes. And that kind of changed everything around a little bit, because a lot of the locations that rise to the top now are locations Well, like our top location of 18 and Medina Line Road, it's what really comes up to the top now are locations where you have like one roadway with higher speeds, and then the intersecting roadway either turns out or runs a red light, and then when there is an accident, it's usually more severe. Those are the ones that always kind of rise to the top now, but we do see many of the same locations. They just kind of change order a little bit. Since we kind of changed our methodology, one of the locations that used to always be on the list was Talmadge Circle. Talmadge Circle has the most crashes of any location in our area. It would have, I think, over 200 crashes in a 3-year period. But because our threshold now is 30% of those have to be injury and fatal crashes, it doesn't even make the list, because most of the crashes are low speed, low impact type crashes where somebody starts to pull out and they stop, and then a car behind them hits them. And so that location doesn't even make the list anymore. So it's kind of a different methodology now, but I think we're going to see a lot of the same locations. And like I said, it's usually where you have a high speed street or road with an intersecting street that where there's high speeds involved. So another example is like some of the intersections on State Route 21. There's some grade crossings like 21 and Eastern Road and 585, and then in Portage County, like Route 5 out that way, 14, 44. It's just any road that involves, higher speeds usually makes the list.
I think one of the things that I'm wondering about, and only because we started with the Safe Streets for All, and then in the safety report, I think Safe Streets for All, if I remember right, is in the opening paragraph of that, is if we could look at this list that is coming out now and the list from 3 years ago and say, oh, well, in that 3-year time, we did these projects and that fell off the list. Or is it just always the same things?
Yes, and that happens too. Sometimes projects are done, and then that location, if it doesn't come off the list, it goes, it goes down significantly. So this information kind of feeds into the Safe Streets for All efforts, but a lot of other information also feeds into that. One of the primary reasons for our list is it helps communities identify locations where they can actually apply for safety money. ODOT has a very, very, very good safety program. I think over $150 million now dedicated to safety, and that it helps communities decide like which locations to maybe target.
Is that ODOT money on top of the money that's now coming from the federal government?
ODOT is, I think the ODOT money is state money. I don't know for sure the roots, I don't know for sure if maybe it originally comes from federal sources, but I think most of it is state money. ODOT has a very, very, very aggressive safety program. A crash can happen in the morning, and with the reporting systems they have now, it's possible to actually see that crash report, to actually look at the crash report that evening or the next day. So a very good data-driven system. So the rest of my presentation was just about the ODOT safety programs. This was intended more for our members who actually are applying, but just briefly, they do have three safety programs. It's called, one is the abbreviated, it's kind of a low cost, quick fix type program. The formal safety program is the one that everyone's interested in because it involves more funding, and it usually these are more high cost, complex projects. And then the systematic or the systemic application process. This is the program where they'll take a low cost improvement and just apply it to all the roads where there's an issue. And an example of that is centerline rumble strips, because a lot of the bad accidents happen on roads like say State Route 5 and Portage County, where you have a two-lane road but high speeds, and one vehicle drifts over the center line, and then bad things happen. So so those are the three safety programs that ODOT has. And lastly, if any of you have a location you're concerned about, I remember once I was at one of these meetings and somebody brought up the intersection of Wioga Lake Road and what was it? North. It was the north end of Wioga Lake Road, Wioga Lake Road and Seasons Road, or Wioga Lake.
Yeah, Road. I think you're right, Dave. Yeah, if it was the northern end,
yeah. It was one of those locations, and it may have not been on our list, but we had some good discussion about it, and it's something now we kind of want to keep our eyes on. So if anyone needs, has any issues they want to discuss, you can call me anytime, or my co-worker Amy Prater. She also is quite involved in the safety study. So that's pretty much it. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Yes.
Just quick, Dave, you probably talked to this, but I might have missed it. The reason that fatalities are up in 2020 and 2021 while accidents are down?
Well, yeah, it's strange. I don't know if anybody knows exactly for sure, but I have heard many speculate that it's possible that there was less traffic. People were staying home, there was less traffic. It enabled people to drive faster. I don't know if I have a good answer for that. There's a lot of speculation. It could be this or could be that. People drinking more, perhaps. I saw in one study I did, I saw that drug use was up quite a bit. I don't know if there's anybody really knows for sure why that happened. But like I said, in 2022, so far we have 49 fatalities or 49 fatal crashes. I mean, we're in December, so hopefully that number, the total number, will come down in 2022.
Okay.
It's just one of those phenomenons that no one expected to happen, but it did, and no one is sure exactly why it happened.
Quite striking.
Yes. Okay. Well, that concludes my presentation. If there's no... And if any of you ever, if you think of something, feel free to call anytime. I'd be glad to love to talk safety.
Thanks, Dave. And again, we can revisit some of this stuff in the open discussion portion, but I did just want to hand it over to Heather to let you know about a couple of grants that AMATS did are looking to approve for Lakemoore.
Sure. So this year we made applications available on our website for our sixth round of funding for our planning grant program. Applications were made available on September 1st. And I want to make sure I mention, we had set aside $80,000 for two $40,000 grants. So the deadline for applications to be submitted was September 30th. We received two applications, both of which were submitted by the Village of Lakemoore. One of those was a joint application with Springfield Township. The Lakemoore application was the Living in Lakemoore study, and the Springfield Township Lakemoore application was the Spartan Trail Extension study. So our Planning Grant Task Force met in October and discussed the applications and how similar they were, as well as some of their differences. But we realized there was a lot of overlap. The task force decided that it would be best to fund the studies together as one, as long as the Village of Lakemoore agreed, which they did. So the recommendation to policy will be to put those two studies together, have a Living in Lakemoore / Spartan Trail Extension study, that the total ask for both of those together was $52,000. So we are well under our budgeted amount. But that's it. So that's what we are going for next week. We're hoping policy approves it, and we're looking forward to getting out there. The Village of Lakemoore, the school district, I guess, in Springfield Township, the Springfield local schools does not have busing for their middle school and high school. And a lot of those kids are walking down Sanitarium Road with no sidewalks and no protection from traffic. So this study will hopefully help them find some solutions for that. So if anyone has any questions, I can answer them. Otherwise, we're excited. We're excited to get started on this.
Great. Thank you, Heather. So that opens us up to the open portion of the meeting. You can either put your questions in the chat or, you know, feel free to have an open discussion.
I was just looking through the chats. I didn't realize these were all being posted. And Mr. Mackey said, is the condition of the road PCR factored into the analysis of the crash site? That's funny. I have thought of that. That kind of be interesting to know. I did want to comment though that it's like a double-edged sword, kind of like. Yeah, as you know, when the PCR, when the road is resurfaced and the PCR goes up, so does speed. And I know there's a lot of people, there's people in residential areas that don't even want their street to be resurfaced because it does that. But it would be interesting to maybe someday we'll try to overlay the PCR layer with the crash layer just to see if anything jumps out.
Yeah, PCR, Mary, is a pavement condition rating. And that's the way that we grade our roadways. It's a number grade from 0 to 100, with 100 being like a perfectly new paved road. And a 50 and lower being a failing road. And so the discussion would be if we did an overlay of the crashes and the pavement condition, you know, could we expect to see more crashes or less crashes? I also saw Danny, you almost seem to be proposing that the better, safer, more cautious drivers were the ones that were off the roads during the pandemic. And I agree with you that that would be difficult to quantify. And then the one thing I did write in there that I do think is interesting that we could definitely expound on is the distracted driving is a very difficult. It's like we know it's happening And, you know, I mean, we've all been behind the driver that, you know, the light turns green and the car doesn't move. And I think we've all, you know, we've all seen it happen, but it's been very difficult for this, for police officers to, you know, definitively say, yes, this person's using their cell phone right before this crash. And people aren't typically also willing to admit it if they don't think they need, I mean, and it's funny, sometimes the crash report will say, you know, driver said they were distracted by X, but a lot of the times they're not. And it's also just one of those things too. And I think most people are aware of that, you know, the people don't use their, some people do, but a lot of people don't use their phone continuously while they're driving. It's down, up, down, up. And so it's also just difficult to say, even if you spot check and, you know, we've actually had people, staff do observations of traffic to try to look at who's looking at their cell phone. And Dave, I can't remember what the last time we did it, it was probably 5 years ago, but I want to say it was the ones that we actively saw using it was, it was a lower percentage than I thought. I want to say somewhere between like 15 and 20% or something like that were actively using their phones at a spot. But it's just,
yeah. I can't help but wonder, sometimes it's so difficult to look into a vehicle.
Right, right.
See that. And actually now, I mean, most, a lot of people, you know, just even have the hands free, you know, few, cell phone option in their car. Right.
Yeah, we've talked about that too, Dave, though, is that what's interesting is that, you know, you've got now, you know, the fancy thing to do on vehicles is to not have buttons to control your radio and control everything. And that's actually, you know, like there have been some studies that are saying that that's not an effective, you know, so if you're reaching for that volume control, you've got to use more hand-eye coordination to find a, you know, a flat spot on the screen where you have to hit a button versus say a round knob that you can find without being less, you know, and being less distracted. So there's, people are looking at a whole myriad of things thinking, could this be the reason, or could this be contributing to the reason? And it's just not very clear. Mr. Mackey was asking about public service announcements regarding the sun, and especially in September. Yeah, it's something we could think about doing. We've done that in the past for deer, for like mating season, and for pedestrians when it comes to October for pedestrians, because of those the it getting darker and kids are still out and it's nice weather. So I think those are definitely things that we could consider in the future.
Yeah, one thing too I wanted to mention. I can't believe this technology isn't out there, but it just, I just wish there was a way that we could, just like we set up a counter to count cars, I wish we could set up something that would tell us the percentage of people on cell phones. I mean, it just doesn't seem like it would be that difficult to, for something to detect if a cell phone is being used or not, but maybe there's, it's, you know, things are always much, much more difficult and complicated than they seem to be. But yeah, it's just, and then too, I agree too, like with the new touch screens and stuff, what I've noticed is it's often like several steps you have to do to get to the volume. Like sometimes you have to, you know, find audio and then find radio and then find volume. It's not as easy as just reaching over and just turning that knob. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, once you get used to the system, it, some of that becomes intuitive, but until then it is, takes your attention away.
Any other topics that people are interested in discussing before we break for the evening? Mr. Brubaker?
Can we talk about Veterans Trail a little bit?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if AMATS is aware of what's going on with Metro RTA and the Federal Transit Administration, and how you see that going forward in a way that will still result in a veterans trail?
Yeah, I think it's something that, so we're definitely aware of it. We've been in touch with the parties. You know, our funding is not in doubt in terms of, you know, we will hold that funding and wait for that project to be ready to go and to use it when it's ready to go. I think the reality is the FTA decision. So Federal Transit Administration has basically told Metro RTA that, you know, hey, you're not allowed to own, you know, if you're not going to use a rail line for a purpose of rail, you need to divest from these rail lines. And they gave Metro RTA a list of seven options that they could use to divest of the rail lines. The preferred option, from my understanding, is to basically transfer them at zero cost to a other local entity. So that would be, that could be potentially Summit County, it could be Metro Parks, it could be Hudson, it could be Stowe, it could be, you know, all those types of communities. That I think is, you know, and I know that Metro RTA is doing their due diligence just to make sure everyone's on the same page with, okay, if they decide to go this route, this is what's going to happen. And, you know, my understanding is I still cannot see a scenario where we don't end up having a trail built here. I think we have to figure out, you know, there's going to be discussions once Metro RTA has said, okay, we know how this is going to go with FTA. I think there will obviously need to be meetings with the locals, the county, and the communities to determine, you know, what kind of proposal is going to be made to FTA for that transfer of that right of way to those public entities. So, you know, as far as I know, and as far as I'm aware, like I'm still, you know, as confident as I can be in this trail. And it's, you know, and I think what we're just waiting to find out now is how that, you know, if Metro decides it, you know, because the other thing they could do is try to sell it for fair market value. And everything I understand is that Metro's preference is to give it to someone. And so that we can build these trails. It's just figuring out how, you know, what does that look like on paper? Does that mean Hudson gets a piece and Stowe gets a piece and Silver Lake, you know, Silver Lake gets a piece? Or does that mean that, you know, it goes over to the county or it goes over to the Metro Parks? And that those discussions, I think right now would be a little premature until Metro has said, okay, this is the path we're taking, and making sure from their perspective, like that this, you know, that we understand what FTA is saying, and that this option is how we understand it to be, and that we think this is going to move forward. So, you know, I still feel positive about it. Obviously, I think in a perfect world, you know, we would have liked FTA not to focus on this. But the reality is that, you know, it was a use in past federal registers to hold it and, you know, allow it to be used for a trail. And that purpose is no longer there in the federal register. And so FTA is basically just enforcing federal law. And sort of that, and that's where we are. I would admit that, you know, it's going to, you know, as I think I wrote to Jerry Egan, I said, like, you know, if building this trail was easy, it would have been done already. And so this is just, it's definitely part of the process, but I think it's a very important part of the process. You know, who gets this property and how it's committed to, and we need to make sure we do that the right way. And that's, you know, and I think that's what Metro RTA is trying to accomplish right now with their team, making sure they know how that process will work.
Just to follow up, I was a little surprised at your comment about transfer to a community at zero cost. Doesn't somebody have to pay the money back to FTA somewhere along the line?
No, not necessarily. I mean, from my understanding is that if Metro would, one of the options Metro could do would be to just sell it outright. If they wanted to sell it outright, then they would have to sell it based on an estimate that, and whatever they would sell it for would need to go back to FTA, you know, like that money, whatever they would sell it to, if they wanted to sell it to, I don't know, some private entity that wanted a rail line, that money, my understanding is it would have to be based on an estimate that FTA approved and would have to be, you know, and then that money, I think, would go back to FTA. However, with the transfer to the public entity, it's my understanding that there actually would not need to be funding provided back to Federal Transit Administration from Metro RTA.
We were in some discussions with First Energy, and they were wondering if they would be considered a valid community.
Yes, I've actually wondered that myself, and I think they might be as a energy regulator. That's actually an interesting wrinkle, and I'm definitely out above my skis here, so don't quote me on this. But my recollection is something kind of similar happened at the with the Headwater Trails in Aurora. You know, there was that abandoned rail line going through Aurora, and First Energy wanted to put a transmission line through there, and there were definitely some negotiations with the community. But I thought that First Energy got that through like a rail abandonment. You know, it was like the private rail line abandoned the rail. And then I believe in that case, it might've been actually FRA that, you know, put out a proposal for that land and somehow First Energy got it. But so there's a part of me that believes that that is actually a possibility.
Anybody else here? Curtis, you froze.
You see me now? Can you hear me now? Am I good?
Your picture's frozen, but your voice is coming through.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just got the warning that my internet is unstable. So I don't know where you stopped hearing me, but I think it's a real possibility. But I couldn't say that with 100% certainty that yes, First Energy would be considered like a no cost transfer partner.
Okay.
And honestly, I think that I could very well see that being a discussion that happens with Metro RTA and Summit County and the other groups, if that's something that, you know, First Energy is going to be a part of. I'm sure that will come up.
There's another message in the chat that sounds interesting.
Let's see here. Mr. Mackey, we're talking about vertical takeoff and landing vehicles. Let's see. Could the right-of-way of railroads that have been converted to trails be listed as flight routes for this new mode? May deconflict these vehicles from just running all over the sky? That is a very interesting question that I don't know the answer to. You know, it's interesting because I feel like these types of vehicles, whether we're talking about drones, you know, these human vehicles that, you know, allow you to fly. I feel like these are all sort of like these Silicon Valley, West Coast, you know, things that we see an article about or a headline, but then they just never make their way here. And so I can honestly say it's not something that we've talked about at all. You know, but I think from the idea of, I think that is a concern, is like, what are flight paths that, you know, these, even with like delivery drones with packages, I think there are going to be concerns about how those go from distribution facilities, you know, to our doorstep. You know, and to me, I'd say let's let I'll let the Federal Aviation Administration worry about that one. So anything else in the...
This is Mary Starbuck. I want to thank everybody for this discussion. I live in an area where there's a school in Kent, and I really, in the past couple of years, I've noticed the buses that drive by, there's a steady stream of about maybe 15 or 20 buses that go, and they speed. To me, it seems that they speed to go, they get to a stop sign and they're going to turn left to go toward the school. But I really feel like they're exceeding the speed limit. And I wondered if this has been any trend in the Amitz area. Are school buses, are the drivers driving safely?
You know, it's a great question, because, you know, I mean, the one thing that I am aware of when it comes to school buses is just the difficulty in all of these, whether it's third party, because I know some companies use like Peterman or some of the, you know, third parties now for their busing. And I know their ability, you know, their difficulty in finding drivers has been incredibly difficult. And so it does make me wonder, you know, if they're probably pulling people off the street that, you know, maybe don't have sort of that traditional background of driving a school bus. And, you know, they obviously, I think, have to have a certain CDL license. But it's interesting that you talked about that with the schools, because I don't think we've ever looked at it from that perspective, but it doesn't surprise me at all, because I feel like there are, you know, new bus drivers coming online every day, and people, you know, and it just seems like, you know, I know my wife's a teacher, and they've had these days where, you know, all of a sudden they're calling a bunch of students and saying like, we, you know, we're going to have to double up the buses and take multiple trips because they don't have enough drivers. And so I don't know if that's something that would be leading to that phenomenon, you know, or is it just someone saying, you guys have to be here on time. So they're speeding up quite a bit. I see. Danny, I don't even want to see that article. I've got kids that ride school buses. I don't want to read that article about bus drivers being drunk. But I think that's an interesting issue. We haven't heard it from other communities or from other folks, other than knowing about the shortage. But it is something that we can put our ear to the ground to and see if we're hearing that from our other communities.
I think speeding in general is a big issue everywhere. Just speeding is probably one of the biggest complaints, I think, that people tend to talk about.
Yeah,
too bad they can't put a governor on the bus.
Yeah.
Speed limit on the street.
Right. Well,
this seems like an easy technological fix.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
The speed limit, that's all the faster they can go.
Yeah, you know, we used to have those when I worked in the trucking industry, but those were for the freeway. The truck could only go, I think it was like 64 miles an hour max. But, you know, maybe for the school buses, we need a 35 mile an hour max or something like that. But,
All right. Thanks a lot.
But yeah, that's a good comment. Anything else for the good of the order before we close?
I have one question. David mentioned the Wioga Lake intersection at the northern end. I saw on the tip there's an STBG grant for Wioga Lake Road in Cuyahoga Falls. I think that's the widening project.
Yes, it's they want to put a turn lane in, and sidewalks and a turn lane.
Do you know, you mentioned sidewalks, do you know if there's going to be a shared use path or anything like that in that area?
Oh, I don't know for sure offhand. Hopefully. Yeah. I'm not sure. I think sidewalks, I did see sidewalks. I don't know about a shared use path. But I mean,
okay,
the difference between a shared use path and a sidewalks just isn't, is basically just some width. So I think having sidewalks where there's none is will be a big improvement.
Yeah, for sure. The reason I was asking is I know there's a shared use path north of Steele's Corners Road on Wyoga Lake Road, but it only goes up to Hardman Road. It's a very short section of path. And I was just wondering if they were planning to extend that further north as part of this project.
I'm not sure offhand. I could check when I tomorrow when I get back to the office and let you know.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great. I'll remind Dave tomorrow morning, Austin, to look that up. But all right. Well, thank you guys as usual. If you have any additional questions or thoughts, just shoot us an email. Thank you for taking the time. Really appreciate it. It was good. A nice turnout tonight. So thank you guys for participating. It always makes it a little bit more interesting for us. So thank you very much.
Thanks for everything you do at AMATS too.
And absolutely.
Holidays to y'all.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you. Enjoy the holidays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, we'll talk to you guys soon. Take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye. Good night.
Thanks.